This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Now available online through Larder Meat Company. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
My name is Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Guys, how many shots did you do for St. Patrick's Day? Because I got one. It was a vaccine shot. That's all I did. I didn't even have a Guinness this year.
Oh, man. That's disappointing.
No, I mean, that's fine. I got my first vaccination. So, like, I had a very responsible 40th St. Patrick's Day of my life.
Wow. So you've got one shot. Greg, you got two.
I got two shots. I'm back. It feels weird. Like it's this, I feel like I have this kind of superpower now. Also, the second shot of Moderna sucks. And I would do that every single day if I had to get everybody fully vaccinated and get back to normal. Like, it's not fun, but it is absolutely worth it.
Second shot, you're saying, is worse than the first?
Second shot is worse than the first. The first one, I sort of had this sense of, you know how, like, back in the olden days when we were like, uh-oh, I feel a cold coming on. I better, you know, drink a bunch of orange juice while I still go to work. That was sort of the feeling that I had after the first shot. The second one was like, nope, I've definitely got something. But I came out the other side, and now I'm actually on one of my first trips in a year. I went back to my hometown to DC, saw my family,
Hopefully soon to be the state of DC.
Hopefully. Oh my God. Yeah. Don't even get me started on that. We can do an entire episode about that. But yes, I have long said that, like, DC statehood is my favorite lost cause of American politics, but it looks like it could really be a thing. Fingers crossed. I mean, there's no real reason not to. It's crazy that the people that live here don't have representation in Congress, but
right, which meets in their city,
which meets in Washington, D.C. Yeah, exactly. I did read something interesting, because up until recently, the issue of DC statehood wasn't particularly popular with other people in the United States. And I think I read this piece that I sort of agree on, that when folks generally think of DC, they think of all the crap that the rest of America sends here and not the people that live here. So they, you know, they don't picture the folks that live in the, you know, the row houses around where I am now in Brookland. You know, they think of Ron Johnson and they're like, I don't want that guy voting. So all of which is to say, hopefully perceptions are changing, and hopefully at some point I will be able to visit the state of Douglas Commonwealth and not the District of Columbia. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you two got your shots. I'm certain that means you've zipped over and picked up a Krispy Kreme donut or two.
No, not yet.
Tell me about this, Souther.
Yeah, you guys hear about this? When you get, I don't know if it's when you get your full course or at least the first one, but Krispy Kreme is willing to give a free donut to everyone who gets vaccinated for every remaining day of the year. So you got, if you're fully vaccinated, you can go to Krispy Kreme. You got 230 something donuts coming your way, pal.
What?
That's going to help you keep the COVID-19 off, right? The weight gain that everybody took on during COVID stacked up against the irresistible nature of the Krispy Kreme donut.
So this isn't just like, you know, when someone steals a base in the World Series, you get like free tacos for a day between 3 p.m. and 5 p.m. It's every day for the rest of the year. You get a free Krispy Kreme donut with your vaccine card.
Yeah. Don't lose that card, man. Laminate that shit.
Yeah. Put it on a lanyard. Wear it around your neck.
It's, you know, that's a really good full memento and just tattoo it on my body.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. You're like on a road trip right now. I mean, that's just economics, dude. You've got free breakfast every day while you're on the road. And you know where Krispy Kremes are? Like, when you're out on the road, they're right by the gas station usually.
Right.
So
that's right. Right. I mean, I assume that means, frankly, that you could stop at every Krispy Kreme in a day that you can get to. How could they possibly? They're not keeping the record, but you show the card, you get a donut. Anyway, that's us trying to game a system. They're just trying to do something nice, Souther. I do love that they are out there trying to do something. And they always do. You know, Krispy Kreme's been it's a fan favorite in the South where I'm from. And, you know, they've always done things like if you get an A on your report card, you can go get a – it's just the plain, the standard Krispy Kreme donut. You can go get one. Or they you know, if your baseball team wins or something, you can go get a free donut. Like, they're always doing that kind of stuff. What I think is interesting is that there's a – you guys haven't seen it, obviously, but there's a huge uproar on the internet from the sort of anti-vax crew that they're upset that they can't get a free donut because they refuse to go get vaccinated. So in response, Krispy Kreme offered 2 days. I think it's maybe it's this Sunday and Monday. 2 days where you can go in and still get a free donut and even a cup of coffee, free donut and a coffee. If you're an anti-vaxxer.
Oh, God. Why are we catering to these people? Like, first of all, I had the best conversation with the woman who has given me my second shot. She was just, you know, one of these old school, tough as nails, hilarious New Yorkers. And we were talking about how ridiculous it is that people are afraid that the government is going to put a tracking device in the vaccine. I got news for you, everybody. We all have tracking devices on us. You're probably listening to this podcast on it right now. And yeah, guess exactly. what? You paid for it. Yep. You set up a payment plan for your own tracking device. Like, they don't need to inject into our bodies. We have them on us at all times. Get the shot. Enjoy your donuts. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well put. Oh, man. Speaking of portable things, I got a little thing in the mail. A few weeks back, you know, there's a lot of like RTDs, ready to drink cocktails out there. And this one's actually a little bit different. I got a cocktail in a box. And it has, it's a cachaça old fashioned. It's got a little bottle of Novo Fogo cachaça, a little tinier bottle of Scrappy's grapefruit bitters, and a little packet of agave nectar. And you've got the whole cocktail. It's got a little wooden stir stick as well, a little like toddy stick. You just throw that in a glass with an ice cube. It's, you know, it's 9 a.m. here in California, so I figured why not start with a Novo Fogo cachaça old fashioned because of our guest today.
That's right. Nice segue.
Yeah. And you can hear, I got it on a big cube, so I feel like I'm actually at a real cocktail bar here.
Yeah, I got a couple of these as well. Greg, did you get a couple?
I did. I didn't have the patience to let it last until this show, though. I tried. I really tried. It survived for like 2 or 3 days in my apartment before I couldn't resist diving in. So now I'm like the kid in that experiment that, like, if you wait 15 minutes to eat this marshmallow, you get a second marshmallow. I failed. I failed that test. So I'll just have to sit here and listen to you both drink it.
Just a random side note on that particular experiment, which is a known one that shows that children have, cognitive ability to understand time and reward. You know, they did that test now with cuttlefish, and cuttlefish pass it. So cuttlefish are as smart as toddlers. Cuttlefish understand reward and time. But that's neither here nor there. Greg, who's in the virtual studio with us today?
Joining us in the virtual studio today, we have Dragos. Oh my God. Ajinte. Did I do that right?
You know, close enough.
Perfect. Dragos Ajinte from Novo Fogo Cachaça. How are you doing today, man?
I'm fine. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, Cachaça is from Brazil. Are you joining us from Brazil today?
No, I live in Seattle. I was actually born in Europe. And I live in Seattle. I just kind of live on work on different continents and try to make the best of it.
Nice.
I'm sure that means that your work flow has been pretty stilted over the past year with the inability to do any traveling, right?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is I've been using Zoom probably for 5 years. And prior to COVID, it's been very difficult to get people to join me at the other end because, you know, computers don't have cameras and the IT department will prevent you from using such complicated software. But now everything has become video calls and it suits us fine. I lack the contact with human beings. I lack being in the company of the most hospitable people on the planet. That stuff is very difficult to deal with, and it's definitely affected both my body and my psyche. But I do have plenty of interaction with people from all over the world on a daily basis, so I get my fill.
I like the fact that you can, that they can see your hangover, but they can't smell your hangover. You know, like it's Zoom's really, you know, been helpful for that at least.
Listen, I had never done a Zoom ever before March of last year, and I count now that I've done 42 of them over the past year for virtual classes / tastings that I've done for generating revenue for myself to keep myself afloat. And I'll tell you this in no uncertain terms, without any holdback, I fucking hate it. not because it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It works. Can I see you? Can I hear you? Can we talk? Can we interact? Yes. What doesn't work, though, is the part of what I do in a bar when I'm tasting things with people or making things with people, it just doesn't translate. And we've had to just kind of square peg, round hole this situation for the past year. And it's been, frankly, it helped keep me afloat. It made me some money. I won't deny that. But, man, I hated every virtual second of it.
Wow, well, Southern.
Yeah. meanwhile, Zoom's profits are 4,000% higher than they were last year.
Yeah.
Just a random fact that I happened to read earlier.
But you know,
today.
As much as you hate Zoom, Zencastr's great, right?
Zencastr's smoking it, man. This is great. The fact that we are able to have guests in from all over the world so much more easily, and frankly, Damon, if it weren't for Zencastr, we wouldn't be able to have you on. So, you know. Really happy that you know, if there's a silver lining to the entirety of COVID for me, it's Zencastr.
Well, I'm a silver lining guy, you know.
Yeah, you are, and you are the silver lining in this.
that's what I'm here for, guys. Speaking of silver linings, this old fashioned is really doing the trick this morning. So thanks for sending these along. When was
David? I have a story about that actually, because you mentioned you're having one of the grapefruit bitters and the agave syrup. We were selling these on cruise ships for a while, and we were doing cocktail classes on cruise ships. And I remember being at sea, setting up for a cocktail class one time on a big ship in the Pacific. And this couple walked by, and he said, "Hey, are you guys the ones with the kids in the rooms?" And we said, "Yes, sir, certainly we are." And the woman said, "Well, I have one of those for breakfast." Just like you, Dana. And we just kind of had this stunned face reaction on for breakfast. And she said, "Yeah, it's a grapefruit on it." So, you know, you can find the silver lining in each way that you want.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, like she wasn't wrong.
Not at all.
So you started making these for cruise ships and, like, I'm assuming different events and types of things like that. I mean, what I love about this is that it's a cocktail in a box for the listeners out there. We can post pictures of it on our Instagram account when we post about the show. The cool thing is, it's a small 50 ml bottle, airplane bottle, a lot of times what we call it. And it has a little vial of bitters and a little packet of agave and a little stir stick. So there's so many like ready to drink cocktails out there these days, but like, I like to work for my drinks a little bit more than just popping a can. Don't get me wrong. There's some really great ones out there. But this one's really fun, especially for me being a bartender who hasn't been able to bartend for a very long time. It's like, I actually feel like I'm getting something done.
Well, plus, unlike an RTD, which you just crack open and drink, this one gives you some customization ability, right?
That's true.
You can put in less of the sweetener, more of the bitters, et cetera. You can, you know, pull a couple of levers and make it more customized to your taste. Silver linings. Yeah, I've got the silver one right here in front of me. Let's talk a little bit about cachaça in general. Dragos, you know, obviously the three of us are pretty familiar with it, but maybe our listener would like a little bit of tuning in. What is cachaça besides being the national spirit of Brazil?
Well, you know, that actually is where it starts, and it's important because the Brazilian government sees cachaça as a cultural ambassador to the world of the country, just like soccer or fashion or car racing. And it puts a lot of emphasis on making this an ambassador to the world. And the reason why is because it's been made for 500 years, so it has a gigantic amount of heritage, a very broad playing field, and a lot of tradition. And it has become a national spirit because it's just about as old as Brazil itself, you see? So it basically is a spirit made from sugarcane in Brazil, and that's it. That kind of defines it. There are very few technical requirements, such as having to be bottled between 38% alcohol and 48% alcohol. But that's it. You can't add anything other than sugarcane. It has to be made in Brazil, and it is a distilled spirit. So its method of fabrication follows the method of making any spirit in the world, which is that you have some kind of plant that grows out of the earth, and you try to squeeze the juice out of that, the sugar out of it, and then ferment that sugar into some kind of wine or beer, and then they distill that into something that's higher proof. It just so happens that extracting sugar from sugarcane is pretty easy. So the process of making this stuff is fairly simple. It could be made without a lot of sophisticated equipment. It could be made in very rural environments. And as a result, it has permeated the entirety of Brazil and all aspects of its life. As a 500-year-old spirit category, it has adapted over the years, over the centuries. It has a lot of diversity from north to south and east to west, from the coast to the savannah and so on. And you see those kinds of differences manifested in the thousands and thousands of brands that exist in the market, many of which are not legally sold. They're sold just at the distillery because they choose not to pay taxes that would make the product otherwise unaffordable by neighbors.
I often choose to not pay taxes.
Well, it's a real problem, Sather. You know, in our state of Paraná, for domestic sales in Brazil, we pay about 60% tax on revenue.
Wow.
Whereas it's no tax for exports, right? So there is a clear priority being given there to exporting. And we're investing less in the Brazil market because of that. But we're also lobbying to lower the taxes, and we've been successful a couple of times, but then the taxes are put back on. It makes it really hard to grow the brand inside of Brazil. At the same time, the opportunity really is outside of Brazil because it is a 500-year-old category in Brazil, but it's a 12, 15-year-old category outside of Brazil.
Yeah, I agree with that. Now, so basically what you're saying, though, is the tax is so high that it's a hurdle to sell it in country. But it's the national spirit of Brazil. Does this mean that that Brazilians are less and less drinking it if there's such an expense?
No, because you still buy it. I mean, if you're in the rural parts of Brazil, you go into a town like ours, Mojitas, which has somewhere between 12 and 15,000 people, you'll find lots of distilleries making it. They're just not legal. And to be legal, you have to do two things. Number one is you have to pay taxes to the IRS, the Receita Federal, and you have to have a license from the Ministry of Agriculture in order to be able to produce a drink product, right? Mm-hmm. And that illegality is one or two or both, basically. But most of them get the license to produce, but they don't pay the taxes because taxes are so high, they would have to double the price. And it's okay to sell locally. It's enough of a living to sell just to your community, your neighbors. And those types of alambiques exist everywhere, everywhere. There are tens and tens of thousands of them all over Brazil.
And that word you just said sounded familiar to me. You said alambique. Is that related to the alambic, the still?
Yeah. That's actually the word for distillery in Portuguese is alambique. Mm-hmm. And it refers to the type of pot still.
So these guys or folks are down there doing all the hard work of getting the cane, getting the juice out, creating this spirit, and then they're just opting to sell it locally, kind of out of in their backyard, basically, so that they can make a living, because they would be punished effectively to try and sell it legally by the taxes.
Yeah, and my guess is, just kind of from studying this over the years, that there are probably about 40, 50,000 producers in Brazil of cachaça. Whoa. But only about 2,000, I think, are legally sold in stores and through distribution.
Well, so we're talking
maybe exported.
We were just in Oaxaca about a year ago, and we were drinking straight from the still everywhere we went, you know?
This is exactly the vision that was in my mind, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's why it's so iconic to see, like, the reused water bottles full of what looks like water, but it surely isn't. And like, that's kind of the
water,
way I've always
it's
thought
water,
about it.
It's water with consequences.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way I've always kind of thought about it, cachaça, because it is like the people's drink in a very, very deep sense of the word, because it is like hyper-localized a lot of times. You know, it seems that they're always grabbing, you know, a bottle from their local producers, and it's not like I feel like a, you know, big company like Leblon, they're like, you know, their focus was kind of becoming like the big brand that's at all the football games in like out there in the world too. I mean, almost like essentially like grabbing that bigger market share, almost like, you know, like your Budweiser of sorts, you know, like that's always like kind of like partnered outward, you know.
David, I have a story that punctuates what you just said. When we started working with the team in Brazil, I was just amazed by the knowledge that they had about the spirit category. And our master distiller, Agenor Macari Jr., is a professor at the university, taught cachaça production for a couple of decades, from sugarcane agriculture all the way to barrel aging. And is probably the only person to have a PhD in cachaça on this planet. And he's an agrochemist, so he's a very studied man. But he, one of the first things he said to me was, if you really want to learn about cachaça, you don't come to me in my lab. You go to see Marcel.
Right.
And I said, who is Marcel? He said, I take you to Marcel. So one day, soon after I arrived in town, he took me to see Marcel, who was this man who had an alambique on the sidewalk, basically. He had a little room that was distillery and retail store. And the sugarcane bagasse, the spent sugarcane after pressing, was literally sitting on the sidewalk. And he was doing everything in one location. And he had the fermentation tank there. And then he had a tiny little still. And then from the still was a pipe that was going through a wall. And I had to go see what was on the other side of the wall. And that on the other side of the wall was where the bucket was collecting the distillate. Awesome. And he was right next to the toilet, of course. And then next door was where he was selling these bottles for 10 reais, which was just like $3 at a time. But all of the bottles that he was using were reused. Like, they'd probably be used 1,000 times. They were so worn out.
And never washed.
But Agenor said, Marcel, this is, if you truly want to understand the spirit of cachaça, you meet people like him. He's important. He's been doing this in his method, learned from his parents, for a very, very long time. Unfortunately, modern times caught up with Marcel, and this is kind of what's happening now, is that he became a little too popular. There were too many people going to write newspaper stories about him or put him in books and so on. And he had an illegal operation. So at some point, the tax man basically got a wind of this and said, we make Marcel into an example, and started to chase him around. Then he'd go to the hills when the tax man would come and then come back, until the day when his daughter got sick while he was away running from the tax man, and he decided this is not worth it. So he shut down the business, and that business no longer exists. So there is a conflict there between history and modern times. And unfortunately, it does come to a fiscal decision of whether or not you want to continue.
It's heartbreaking. And it seems like there should be some tax reform, put into place so that it's less cost prohibitive to sell locally. It seems like a tough hurdle to overcome. Let's take a break and hear from our sponsors. We're going to come right back and keep talking with Dragos about the national spirit of Brazil, cachaça. I want to talk about its relationship to rum when we come back. So we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. The Hearst family has raised cattle on California's Central Coast since 1865. Today, Hearst Ranch's signature product is their 100% grass-fed, completely hormone and antibiotic-free beef. The Hearst Ranches have always treated their animals with great care. Their cattle live a completely natural existence as foragers and grazers. Well-managed grazing fertilizes the land naturally, sustains a seasonal rhythm to the ranches, and produces a remarkable meat whose flavor is the authentic taste of the American West. Hearst Ranch beef is available seasonally, May through August, in select Whole Food markets throughout California, and all year round at their retail locations in San Simeon and Paso Robles. And now, HRN listeners in Arizona, Nevada, and California can get Hearst Ranch beef delivered right to their door through Larder Meat Company. Go to lardermeatco.com and shop the 100% grass-fed box to stock your freezer with Hearst Ranch beef. That's LARDER, meatco.com. Learn more about the storied history, farming practices, and conservation efforts of Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
And
We are back. You were listening to The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. Today we are joined by Dragos Achinte from Nova Fogo Cachaça. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about the history of this spirit and, you know, how a very traditional way of making it is kind of running and bumping up against modern times, not always with the best results. But I really want to talk about this relationship to rum, how this spirit is in a lot of ways predates what we think of as rum, and how it's a close cousin, but also kind of different to this much more well-known part of the spirits world.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And Greg, I think of cachaça and rum agricole as primary cousins and rum as their distant cousin. Because in particular, cachaça and rum agricole are made from freshly pressed sugarcane juice, which makes them rawer, more vegetal, more reflective of their terroir, whereas rum most of the time comes from cooked juice, molasses, basically, right? And that's a primary difference. Geographic origin also is important too. Obviously, cachaça can only be made in Brazil. Rum agricole is from the Caribbean, but rum can be made all over the world. Rum has fewer rules as well. So you see the origin reflect itself in the taste. In particular, rum agricole being created in the maritime environment has a brinier taste, and cachaça being created in a more tropical environment has a fruitier taste. For us, we at Nova Fogo, we happen to be kind of in the middle of all that. We're on the coast, but we're also in the rainforest with a lot of fruit orchards around us. So we're somewhere between the traditional cachaça and the savory rum agricole. Cachaça is also distilled and bottled at lower proofs, whereas rum agricole is distilled and bottled at higher proofs. That's just custom, you know, heritage. And rum, of course, again, is all over the place. So there are many similarities. There are also many differences. And I think what's interesting to know is that cachaça has been around for about 100 years longer than rum. It's as a 500-year-old category, it precedes rum by about 100. And the story is that basically, the Portuguese brought sugarcane they had discovered in the West Indies to South America. And then they brought slaves from Western Africa to South America to work the plantations. And those dark beginnings set in motion a heritage of tears and tragedy, but also of positive discovery and innovation, and eventually some level of joy too, but not without conflict. So as the Portuguese were the colonists on the coast of Brazil in the 1500s, the Dutch arrived there too. And late in the 1500s, around the turn of the century, naturally the two of them started a war with each other. The Dutch lost to the Portuguese and had to leave. So they started to move up northward into Suriname and Guyana, and eventually the Caribbean. And they arrived in Barbados. But the Dutch were, in fact, making cachaça in Brazil, because everybody was making cachaça in Brazil at that point. They were growing sugarcane. They found out about sugarcane. They were distilling it. And they were making this thing. And they started doing the same thing in the Caribbean, where they discovered that perhaps there is also an opportunity to make a spirit from cooked sugarcane, which gave certain economic benefits. And so at this point in time, Barbados was an English colony. And these Dutch people were making some distilled spirit from sugarcane from Brazil, which the Portuguese had taught them to do. So this is a very interesting situation, because at this point in time, Great Britain did not have a spirit of itself. Gin arrived later. It did not have a wine industry. It just made ale. And so Barbadian rum and eventually Caribbean rum became a thing for England. The British Navy started to take barrels of rum to Britain. It became the national spirit. And as a result, a very gigantic amount of rum was produced in the first three decades or so of the 17th century, in the early 1600s. And the British Navy became the rum ambassador to the world over the course of centuries. This is very interesting, because this is why everybody knows about rum all over the world. And now you compare that to the story of cachaça, which stayed in Brazil because the Portuguese did not need to take it back to the old continent. They already had their spirits. They already had wine. And they left it in Brazil. Brazil, of course, grew in time, became a gigantic country, and the category grew within Brazil. But it has not gotten outside of its borders until the last two decades, which is why we're trying to be the British Navy right now, make cachaça something that's known to the world. We're just starting a few hundred years late.
Well, that's right. Interesting because I always Kinshasa was one of those spirits to me that I feel like every summer for like 4 or 5 years there, people would be like, this is going to be the summer where Kinshasa really takes off. Like it's going to be the next Mezcal. Like this is good. This is the summer of Kinshasa. And I do feel like, I don't know that we ever had like the summer of Kinshasa, like the moment when it really caught fire, but I do feel like it's arrived. Like people know it. I haven't had someone ask what Kachaka was in a really long time, so that's a good sign. But I'm curious what it was like to work on this spirit that is kind of funky and grassy and fruity and like rum, but not what people who are used to drinking Captain Morgan are expecting from rum. What was it like to work on this and work in this industry and try and grow this field and educate people about what Kinshasa was and where it came from and why it's so delicious?
Well, it was definitely hard and it still is, but less so. I think you're right. It hasn't arrived. There's no single event that's going to make it arrive. It's just arriving in small bits, you know, and it will take some time. Think about how long it took for tequila to become a thing in the United States. It wasn't overnight. But yeah, when we started this company, I saw a lot of opportunity to create, to bring something that was so prevalent in a big country, the size and the population size nearly of the United States, and bring it here and give it a new identity, not a new identity, but a new presentation to that identity and make it relevant here. And I thought we should be able to do that. I had done that before as an entrepreneur. But very clearly it became obvious to me that I can't sell Novo Fogo Kinshasa before I can explain to people what Kinshasa is and why they need it. And literally, we started here in Washington State when the state was still controlled, and we were lucky to get distribution in 200 stores right away because we were a local company. And I'd go to the stores, the control, the state stores, to talk to them about our bottles. They were on their shelves. And I introduced myself and I say, hi, my name is Dragos. I am with Novo Fogo Kinshasa. And the invariable response to all of that was, man, I didn't understand a word you said. Because all those words were for it. Like, what are you saying? You know, we don't have that product. And I'm like, you have it. It's right there on the shelf. No, we don't have it. Okay, it's that curvy bottle. Remember the curvy bottle? Now they remember the bottle. So it was from zero we had to start. Right. And then we basically, the strategy that we had was that I do love cachaça. And I travel in many parts of Brazil, and I learned about the cachaça tradition, history and heritage and the methods and how people enjoy it and how it kind of meshes within the fabric of Brazilian identity. And I was very happy to share my knowledge with Bartenders of America. So I started doing these cachaça classes where I basically bring a variety of different bottles, including Marcel's bottles, to these classes and show to my audience the diversity. And it was fascinating because at that point in time, most bartenders in the U.S. had tasted maybe two cachaças and they were both industrial. They had no idea that there even was aged cachaça. So it was little by little by little. And we weren't the only ones doing this, but we put in a lot of work, and I think we're starting to see that the craft bartending world, like you said, has caught up to it. And now we're trying to make it a thing for mass retailers and see if we can create more engaging, more approachable opportunities for people who don't go to craft bars to buy this in a grocery store and enjoy it. And Damon, that's why we have that little cocktail kit that is in your hand right now, because that is a more approachable way to experience cachaça. And that's why we actually do have RTDs. Sparkling caipirinhas.
I love those.
Carbonated them, put them in a can.
Hot day by the pool. That thing rocks. Definitely had a few of them. So you're out there being an evangelist for this category as a whole, and certainly your brand. And you are stationed there in Seattle, but obviously you're making down in Brazil. But you're in the middle of the rainforest. Talk about just sheerly the location, how long it takes to get there, et cetera.
That's a good point. Yeah, you may have heard stories about that. From my house,
I've heard a few, but let's share them. Yeah,
yeah. My total trip is 30 hours, door to door, or more. That's the minimum. It could be 36 hours. It's taken me as long as 42 hours. So it is exhausting, and you know, when you get there, you're tired for a week. But it is also an inspiring place because we are in coastal mountains. It's called, the area is called Serra do Mar, Mountains of the Sea, overlooking the Atlantic coast, and the entire area is blanketed by Floresta Atlântica, the Atlantic rainforest. It is a magical place of mountain, forest, and sea. And as a result, the air is very clean. The trees create that kind of purity in the air. And you can smell everything. It's really a true story of spirits terroir, because you're just standing there and you smell the sea salt and you smell the banana blossoms and you smell the lime and the passion fruit and the grassiness of the rainforest, kind of that funk. And all of that ends up in our sugarcane. So the sugarcane is this very unique gift that this land gives us that is both savory and tropical at the same time, sweet and salty. Literally, I can taste sea salt in our cane. And as a result, we say, well, it's really the starting place for everything that we do. So let's not change it. Let's make sure that our process is as simple and as pure as possible. So we're employing this traditional method of very uncomplex steps to ensure that by the time we put liquid in the bottle, it smells and tastes like that place that it comes from, right? And it defines us. It's also why it became basically the area and the people of the area became the foundation for our brand story. When we arrived there for the first time, we were just absolutely blown away. We were in love. We were inspired that your headache lifts, your chest opens, your stress level goes down. You say, I want to be part of this, right? And then you also say, when I leave here, I want to take a piece of this with me and I want to tell everyone about it. So Cachaça became that platform for us to speak about a different world and a different life. And very quickly we learned, although we had in our minds that, you know, we're going to do organic agriculture, we're going to be sustainable and tell the story of the simple life. By the time we arrived there, we realized we don't have to do any of those things because they're already being done. This is just life in this community that has coined this term called La Vida Mais Simples, the simple life. And we just had to fit in, let them continue to do what they were doing, and then bring that story back to the United States with us. But it became a very important dynamic that said, if you want to continue to have this exceptional product that is the derivative of this exceptional place, and if you want to have people who work in this very difficult agricultural context, you know, agriculture in the rainforest is very tough, then you have to take care of them all. And we're obsessed with balance, and we're obsessed with the concept that what goes wrong comes around, and you put in, you get only what you put in. And we said there are tenets of sustainability here that have to make this business move forward as a whole. So these three tenets for us are the following. You invest in the community, which includes your own team. You protect your environment, and you seek economic success so you can continue to make this work. And that's really the foundation of our company. And we employ these rules at the origin, and then we try to mirror them at the destination, and we try to find ways to simplify our value system on a daily basis so that decisions that come to us daily, big and small, are easy to answer because you have the same filter in everything that you do.
Sure, you can just constantly refer back to those three tenets and make sure that you're sticking to them, and then the business moves forward. Let's talk about tenet number two there a little bit, about taking care of the environment. Talk to me a little bit about the unendangered forest program.
Yeah. Well, you know, we do a lot of things from an environmental standpoint because we have to. We can't throw away waste in the river. You know, it's such a fragile environment. We can't burn sugarcane because you'll burn the forest. And of course, we wouldn't do that. But just practically speaking, nobody would do that if they were smart at all. But our idea was that we can speak about things and we can do things within our little world, and we are going to be a model corporate citizen in this model community, but we really need to get outside of that, and we need to influence others too. And over the years, we had noticed that the heritage of aging cachaça in native Brazilian woods was dissipating because of the 300 native species of Brazilian woods, most of them are endangered. And that includes the couple of dozen types of woods that have been historically used to rest or age cachaça. And yet the cachaça industry was not recognizing this. And in part, it's not recognizing this because there's a lack of information. Information in Brazil is really hard to find. There's no consolidated source for whatever. You have to hire people to do the research for you. And the second thing was that they perhaps didn't care. There was economic incentive to continue to put liquids in these indigenous but rare woods because there was a market opportunity for it. And they didn't really care how they got to that economic success. And we said, well, we're not doing it, but we need to tell others about not doing it. And then we need to do something to reverse the wrongs. And that is how we got to the unendangered forest. The idea was that we wanted to take some of the species that are threatened, they're on the threatened list, that perhaps are utilized in the cachaça industry, and see if we can affect a decrease or a reversal of their increased threatened role. Because there are six or seven different levels of threatened. And in my time doing this business, I have seen some species move three or four layers in just a few years, which tells you that something that is abundant today could become extinct in 20 years. And that's a scary, scary thought.
Wow.
There's no time to leave it for the next generation to fix, you know? So we did not know how to do this. So we asked a friend, a scientist named Dr. Sylvia Ziller, who's a reforestation specialist and invasive species specialist who has worked with the Nature Conservancy and many other groups around the world, to come and help us figure out how to plant trees on our property. And that was really the mandate at the beginning. Let's plant trees, just like everybody else says. And then she came and she taught us that just planting trees is stupid. You need to do it right. And you need to do it in very considerate ways. You need to consider science. And you could actually be damaging your environment if you're planting the wrong trees or planting them in the wrong way. So we developed a program over the last couple of years that has truly evolved significantly. And it kind of goes like this, guys. We have botanists who go out into the rainforest on weekends, their days off, and they look for 36 species of trees that Sylvia has identified as either threatened or about to become threatened. In some cases, they're endemic, which means that they only grow in our part of the world, which puts them at even higher risk of extinction. And of course, some of them may also be used by the cachaça industry. And we geotag these trees. We have 230 mother trees, as we call them right now, geotagged in our area, within 30, 40, 50 mile diameter circle. And then we put those on a schedule. We know when every single one of them is going to flower and thus create seeds. And they go back to these trees at the right time and they collect the seeds. And this is because we can't depend on nurseries to get seeds or seedlings or saplings of these trees. They are so rare, we literally have to find the mother source in the wild. We take the seeds and take them to our partner nursery at Ecoa Park, which is a marvelous, marvelous multi-1,000-acre ecological park that has built a nursery for us with only natural construction materials, nothing chemical. And we plant these seeds and let them grow there for about 3, 6, 9 months, usually averaging about 6 months, until they grow into a yay big tree, maybe about 18 inches, something we call a sapling. And when that sapling feels sturdy enough to be moved to its forever home, we do so. And at the beginning, we're just moving them to our property. We very quickly learned that you can't just do that. Most trees will die. Some of them need shade. So you need to plant primary trees to create, in 6 years, shade for the secondary growth trees and so on. And at some point, we also ran out of space, and we decided that we can't put all the trees on our property. So we started to recruit other property owners in our area. And now we have 24 property owners in less than 2 years, many of them owners of resorts who have a preservation mentality just like us, who maybe have set up natural preserves so that they're protected forever. And they're planting trees under the guidance of Sylvia. We have a guide. We have a way to instruct these people on how to do it right. And we're now creating a digital tracking mechanism so we can see every one of these plants from the mother tree to the nursery to the forever home, and monitor its health over the first few years in the forever home as well. So already we've planted thousands of these threatened trees. We have thousands of seedlings at the nursery. We have more property owners lined up. And we have a gigantic natural preserve that stretches over three states, because it's a coalition of large landowners willing to expand the project onto this. So we have these big ambitions. We're kind of the headquarters of a project that should be way bigger than us, but we're trying to be the brain that leads with science and discipline so that it can scale up, so they can plant millions of trees, so that it, we can take some of these species off the threatened list. And I think we're very quickly making progress towards that. So this project was an idea 2 years ago, and now it has definitely become our legacy project, and it's the one that defines our brand. And I hope that will make an impact, and I hope that others will learn to do similar things in their own communities.
As a huge hippie, I love this. I've always loved this story about the brand, so it's cool to hear it again from you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Positive spread solder. You're right. That's really the main concept here. You do the right thing. That's actually the foundation of this business. My wife, Emily, and I created this business. We were looking for partners who were basically already role models in their communities, who were doing the right thing for natural resources, for their communities, and so on. We said, let's amplify those voices. Let's help them become economically successful so that the people around them see that. They can learn that you can do well by doing right, and they can start doing the same thing too, because positivity spreads.
Yeah, positivity definitely spreads. Man, Kinshasa as a whole, still a fascinating story to continue to unfold, especially here in America. Your brand in particular, with all these initiatives that you're taking on to make sure that you're leaving a legacy and doing the right things, it's really incredible. It's great to have you on. Sadly, we're kind of running out of time here, but we'd love to have you back on and talk to you more. I know we were going to talk about the fact that your distillery is zero waste and how you reuse and upcycle all the waste that you produce to run the distillery itself. And how you are also employing sustainable practices on keeping employees and keeping people healthy and in good positions. So we'll definitely try to have you back on again to talk about even deeper into your company.
Yeah, carbon negative, which is the only negative thing that we actually want to talk about.
Yes. Sometimes it pays to be negative, Tim.
Exactly. But in the meantime, if people want to see you, get a hold of you, see the brand, get a hold of the brand, where can we point them for you?
Our social media is very easy. We're at Noel Fogo everywhere. And my email is tree, like the plant, at noelfogo.com.
That's perfect. That's Novo Fogo, Novofogo, Novo Fogo.
You're fired.
Yeah, really, really great to have you on, Dragos. You're out there doing some pretty inspiring work with still a category that, again, is I don't know. It's got to be hard work for you to get the message out there. But I think there's a little bit of mystery behind Kinshasa, and I think that's intriguing. So people are probably starting to be a little bit more willing to listen. So really great to have you on.
Thank you very much. We'll always have new things to talk about too, because this pursuit of sustainability is never, it's not something that you ever finish. You always have to keep adding new initiatives on after the other. So I would love to talk to you guys again.
Yeah, great. Well, absolutely. Make you a recurring guest, have you on once a year to give us the update.
Sounds good. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, buddy. Listen, fellas, before we go, I want to mention that, World Class is happening this year. It didn't get to happen last year because obviously the global pandemic, but World Class is back.
Diageo World Class, right?
Diageo World Class, of course, brought to you by the USBG. They are back. This year they're going to go virtual. It'll be unlike any bartending competition we've ever seen, I believe. It's going to be, the best of the best coming together to do virtually. Shaking and stirring from coast to coast, and the four unique challenges, and they'll be competing for a chance to represent the United States in the global finals, which will be held in Madrid, and I believe that Madrid will be in person by that time, but I don't think they've quite released that yet, but the goal is to get to a place where the finalists from all over the world can travel. But either way, the virtual broadcast is going to start on this Monday, the 29th of March, and it features 5 days of exciting events, trend-led education, amazing panels, and of course, a fierce competition. You can go and register for that at worldclass2021.eventcore.com, or just go follow them on Instagram at worldclassus. And there's links to register, so you can follow all these amazing events, which are all, by the way, free. So you can go and check out all of this cool-ass stuff.
Yeah, there's something cool about World Class is, like, obviously it's like one of the biggest, if not one of the biggest. Typically on these World Class runs, they're they've got people shaking cocktails and airplanes and doing all kinds of crazy shit. It's pretty cool. It's cool that they're able to do this virtually this year.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty exciting. And I think, you know, as a participant in World Class back when it first came to the United States some years ago, I feel like I got a lot out of it. And we had live audience, but they were only local to where we were here in New York City. So I think it's pretty cool that it's going to be virtual. And so you can be, you know, in the comfort of your own home, shaking and stirring up your own drink and check out the action. So I think they'll have the biggest audience that they've ever had this year because of the virtual aspect. Which, you know, only applies pressure, and pressure makes competition good, right?
That's true.
Absolutely.
Well, guys, that's all I've got for this week, unless you have anything else to add.
I just, like, you know, I've had this wonderful Novo Fogo Old Fashioned, and now it's almost 10 o'clock where I live, and maybe I'll go get a Krispy Kreme donut.
Treat yourself, man.
Highly recommend. Highly recommend.
All right, guys. Well, this has been great. Dragos, I've been a fan of Novo Fogo for a very long time, and it's always in my bar. And I'm just extremely thankful for all the practices that you're incorporating with the distillery. And, you know, like I said, you know, I'm a huge hippie, so, like, these kinds of things really, like, speak to me. And
we all are a little bit.
Yeah. So we can't wait to have you back on the show at a future date and continue the conversation with you.
Can't wait to see you guys in person too.
Absolutely. That obviously that's the ultimate goal, right? Cool. Yeah. All right. Well, that's it for the Speakeasy this week. Check out Heritage Radio Network for many more programs like this one. Click on the beating heart to donate to the station. Until next time. Cheers, everyone.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers. Enjoy that donut. Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.